Dawson reached the battlefield and found them. He would not have been able to recognize them or be certain of how many bodies, not after all these months, not after the hyena and vultures. Robin, please. Mungo held out a hand to her, but she recoiled from him. I won't believe it. Clinton could have escaped. In the bush, Dawson met the senior Induna of the Matabele. He is coming in with all his people to surrender. He described to Dawson the patrol's last stand and how in the end they all died. Clinton could have... She was very pale, shaking her head firmly. Robin, it was Gandang. He knew your husband well. Chlopi, he called him. The man with white hair. He saw him lying with the other dead. It is certain there can be no more hope. You can go now, she said. And then quite suddenly she was weeping, standing very erect and chewing her lower lip to try and stop herself. But her face had crumpled, and the rims of her eyelids turned rosy pink with grief. I cannot leave you like this, he said, and limped down the stoop towards her. Don't come near me, she husked through her tears, and she retreated before him. Please, don't touch me. He came on lean and rangy as an old Tom Leopard, but the cruel and swarthy planes of his face had softened with an expression she had never seen upon them before. And his one good eye held her swimming green ones with a deep and tender concern. Don't! Oh, please don't! Now she held up both hands, as if to ward him off, and she turned her face away. She had reached the end of the veranda. Her back was pressed to the door of the bedroom, which Kathy and Selina had once shared, and she began to pray, her voice muffled by her own tears. Oh, gentle Jesus, help me to be strong. His hands fell upon her shoulders. They were hard as bone and cool through the thin cotton of her blouse. She shuddered and gasped. Have pity, I beg you, let me be. He took her chin in the cup of his hand and forced her face up to his. Will you give me no peace ever? She mumbled brokenly. And then his mouth covered hers, and she could not speak again. Slowly the rigidity went out of her body, and she swayed against him. She sobbed once and began to slump into the embrace of his hard, muscled arms. He caught her behind the knees and around the shoulders and lifted her like a sleeping child against his chest. He kicked open the door to the bedroom, stepped through and pushed it closed with his heel. There was a dust sheet on the bed, but no pillow or eiderdown. He laid her upon it and knelt beside her, still holding her to his chest. He was a saint, she choked, and you sent him to his death. You were the very devil. Then, with the shaking, frantic fingers of a drowning woman, she unfastened the mother-of-pearl buttons down the front of his linen shirt. His chest was hard and smooth, the olive skin covered with crisp, dark curls. She pressed her opened lips to it, breathing deeply the man-smell of him. Forgive me, she sobbed. Oh, God, forgive me. From his cubbyhole beside the pantries, Jordan Ballantyne could overlook the cavernous kitchens of Krotescu. There were three chefs at work over the gleaming, anthracite-burning Arga ranges, and one of them hurried across to Jordan with the enamelled double boiler and a silver spoon. With it, Jordan tasted the béarnaise sauce that would go with the chalyun. The chalyun was a fish of the stormy Cape waters. Fancifully, its shape could be likened to that of a Spanish galleon, and its delicate greenish flesh was one of the great African delicacies. Perfect, Jordan nodded. Parfait, Monsieur Galliard. Comme toujours. The little Frenchman scurried away, beaming, and Jordan turned to the heavy teak door leading to the wine cellars below the kitchens. Jordan had personally decanted the port that afternoon. 10 bottles of the 40-year-old Villanova de Gaia of the 1853 vintage. It had faded to the beautifully tawny colour of wild honey. Now a Malay waiter in long white kanzu robes, with crimson sash and pillbox fez, came up the stone steps, reverently carrying the first Waterford glass decanter on a Georgian silver tray. Jordan poured a thimbleful into the chased silver tasvan, which he wore on the chain about his neck. He sipped, rolled it on his tongue, and then drew breath sharply through pursed lips to let the wine declare itself. I was right, he murmured. What a fortunate purchase. Jordan opened the heavy leather-bound wine register and noted with pleasure that they still had 12 dozen bottles of the Villanova, after he had deducted today's decanting. In the remarks column he wrote, Extraordinary, keep for best, and then turned back to the Malay steward. So then, Ramala, we will offer a choice of Sherry Fino's Palma or Madeira with the soup, with the fish the Chablis or the 1889 Cru. Quickly Jordan ran down the menu, and then dismissed him. The company will be coming through presently. Kindly see that everyone takes their places now. The 12 waiters stood with their backs to the oak panelling of the dining hall, their white-gloved hands clasped in front of them, expressionless as guardsmen, and Jordan gave each one a quick appraisal as he passed, looking for a stain on the brilliant white robes or a sloppily knotted sash. At the head of the long table he paused. The service was the silver-gilt Queen's pattern presented to Mr. Rhodes by the directors of the chartered company. The glass was long, finely stemmed Venetian, lipped with 22-carat gold to complement the gilt. There were 22 settings this evening, and Jordan had agonized over the seating arrangements. Finally, he had decided to place Dr. Jamieson at the bottom of the table and put Sir Henry Loch, the High Commissioner, on Mr. Rhodes's right. He nodded his satisfaction at that arrangement and took one of the Alfonso Havanas from the silver humidor and sniffed it before crackling it against his ear. That, too, was perfect. He replaced it and took one last lingering look around the hall. The flowers had been arranged by Jordan's own hands, great banks of protea blooms from the slopes of Table Mountain. In the centrepiece, yellow English roses from the gardens of Grotesquieu, and, of course, Mr. Rhodes's favourite flowers, the lovely blue plumbago blossom. From beyond the double doors came the clatter of many feet on the marble floor of the hall, and the high, almost querulous voice which Jordan knew and loved so well carried to him. "And we shall have to square the old man." Jordan smiled fondly at the words. The old man was certainly Kruger, the president of the Boer Republic, and square was still one of the central words in Mr. Rhodes's vocabulary. Just before the doors swung open to admit the company of brilliant and famous men clad in sombre dinner jackets, Jordan slipped out of the hall, back to his little cubbyhole. But he raised the hatch beside his desk an inch, so that he could hear the conversation at the long glittering table in the hall beyond. It gave him a glorious feeling of power to be sitting so close to the centre of all this and to listen to the pulse of history beating, to know that it was within him subtly to alter and direct and to do so in secrecy. A word here, a hint there, even something so trivial as the placing of two powerful men side by side at the long dinner table. On occasions, in privacy, Mr. Rhodes would actually ask, "What do you think, Jordan?" and would listen attentively to his reply. The tumultuous excitement of this life had become a drug to Jordan, and barely a day passed that he did not drink the heady draught to the full. There were special moments that he treasured and whose memory he stored. When the meal ended and the company settled down to the port and cigars, Jordan could sit alone and gloat over these special memories of his. He remembered that it had been he who had written out that legendary check in his own fair hand for Mr. Rhodes to sign the day that they had bought out the Kimberley Central Company. The amount had been £5,338,650, the largest cheque ever drawn anywhere in the world. He remembered sitting in the visitors' gallery of Parliament as Mr. Rhodes rose to make his acceptance speech as Prime Minister of the Cape Colony, how Mr. Rhodes had looked up and caught his eye and smiled before he began speaking. He remembered after that wild ride down from Matabeleland, when he had handed the Rudd concession with Lobengula's seal upon it to Mr. Rhodes, how he had clasped Jordan's shoulder and with those pale blue eyes conveyed in an instant more than 1,000 carefully chosen words ever could. He remembered riding beside Mr. Rhodes's carriage down the Mall to Buckingham Palace and dinner with the Queen, while the Union Castle mail ship delayed its sacred sailing by 24 hours to wait for them. This very morning had added another memory to Jordan's store, for he had read aloud the cable from Queen Victoria to our well-beloved Cecil John Rhodes, appointing him one of Her Majesty's Privy Councillors. Jordan started back to the present. It was after midnight, and in the dining hall Mr. Rhodes was abruptly breaking up the dinner in his characteristic fashion. "Well, gentlemen, I'll bid you all a good night's rest." Quickly, Jordan rose from his desk and slipped down the servants' passageway. At the end, he opened the door a crack and anxiously watched the burly, appealingly awkward figure mount the stairs. The company had done justice to Jordan's choice of wine, but still Mr. Rhodes's tread was steady enough. Though he stumbled once at the top of the sweeping marble staircase, he caught his balance, and Jordan shook his head with relief. When the last servant left, Jordan locked the wine cellar and the pantry. There was a silver tray left upon his desk, and on it a glass of the Villanova and two water biscuits spread thickly with salted beluga caviar. Jordan carried the tray through the silent mansion. A single candle burned in the lofty entrance hall. It stood upon the massive carved teak table in the centre of the floor. Jordan paced slowly across the checkerboard of black and white marble paving, like a priest approaching the altar, and reverently he laid the silver tray upon the table. Then he looked up at the carved image high in its shadowy niche, and his lips moved as he silently began the invocation to the bird goddess Panis. When he had finished, he stood silent and expectant in the fluttering light of the candle, and the great house slept around him. The falcon-headed goddess stared with cruel, blind eyes into the north, 1,000 miles and more towards an ancient land now blessed or cursed with a new name, Rhodesia. Jordan waited quietly, staring up at the bird like a worshipper before a statue of the Virgin, and then suddenly in the silence, from the bottom of the gardens, where grew the tall dark oak trees that Governor van der Stel had planted almost 200 years before, came the sad and eerie cry of an eagle owl. Jordan relaxed, and backed away from the offering that he left upon the table. Then he turned and went bounding up the marble staircase. In his own small room, he quickly stripped off his clothing that was impregnated with the odours of the kitchen. Naked, he sponged down his body with cold water, admiring his own lithe form in the full-length mirror on the far wall. He scrubbed himself dry with a rough towel and then rinsed his hands in eau de cologne. With a pair of silver-backed brushes, he burnished his hair until his curls shone like whirls of pure gold wire in the lamplight. Then he slipped his arms into the brocaded gown of midnight blue satin, belted it around his waist, picked up the lamp to light his way, and stepped out into the passage. He closed the door to his bedroom quietly and listened for a few seconds. The house was still silent. Their guests slept. On silent bare feet, Jordan glided down the thick carpet to the double doors at the end of the passage, to tap lightly on one of the panels, twice, then twice again. And a voice called to him softly, "Enter!" "These are a pastoral people. You cannot take their herds away from them." Robin Ballantyne spoke with a low, controlled intensity, but her face was pale and her eyes sparkled with furious green lights. "Please, won't you be seated, Robin?" Mungo St. John indicated the chair of rough, raw lumber, one of the few furnishings in this adobe mud hut that was the office of the administrator of Matabele Land. "You will be more comfortable, and I will feel more at ease." Nothing could make him appear more at ease, she thought wryly. He lolled back in his swivel chair, and his booted ankles were crossed on the desk in front of him. He was in shirt sleeves, without a tie or cravat, and his waistcoat was unbuttoned. "Thank you, General. I shall continue to stand until I receive your answer." The costs of the relief of Matabele Land and the conduct of the war were borne entirely by the Chartered Company. Even you must see that there must be reparation. "You have taken everything. My brother, Zuka Ballantyne, has rounded up over 125,000 head of Matabele cattle. The war cost us £100,000. "All right," Robin nodded. "If you will not listen to the voice of humanity, then perhaps hard cash will convince you. The Matabele people are scattered and bewildered. Their tribal organizations have broken down. The smallpox is rife amongst them." "A conquered nation always suffers privation, Robin. Oh, do sit down. You're giving me a crick in the neck. Unless you return part of their herds to them, or at least enough for milk and slaughter, you are going to be faced with a famine that will cost you more than your neat little war ever did. The smile slipped from Mungo St. John's face, and he inclined his head slightly and studied the ash of his cigar. Think about this, General. When the Imperial government realizes the extent of the famine, it will force your famous chartered company to feed the Matabele. What is the cost of transporting grain from the Cape? £100 a load? Or is it more now? If the famine approaches the proportions of genocide, then I will see to it that Her Majesty's government is faced with such a public outcry, led by humanitarians like Labouchere and Blunt, that they may be obliged to revoke the charter and make Matabele a crown colony after all. Mungo St. John took his bottle off the desk and sat upright in his chair. "Who appointed you to champion these savages anyway?" he asked, but she ignored his question. "I suggest, General, that you relay these thoughts to Mr. Rhodes before the famine takes a hold." She gloried in the visible effort it took him to regain his equanimity. "You may well be right, Robin." His smile was light and mocking again. "I will point this out to the directors of the company." "Immediately," she insisted. "Immediately." He capitulated, and spread his hands in a parody of helplessness. "Now, is there anything else you want of me?" "Yes," she said. "I want you to marry me." He stood up slowly and stared at her. "You may not believe this, my dear, but nothing would give me greater pleasure. Yet I am confused. I asked you that day at Kami Mission. Why now have you changed your mind? I need a father for the bastard you've got on me. It was conceived 4 months after Clinton's death." "A son," he said. "It will be a son." He came around the desk towards her. "You must know that I hate you," she said. His single eye crinkled as he smiled at her. "Yes, and that is probably the reason that I love you." "Never say that again," she hissed at him. "Oh, but I must. You see, I did not even realize it myself. I always believed that I was proof from such a mundane emotion as love. I was deceiving myself. You and I must now bravely face up to that fact. I love you. I want nothing from you but your name, and you shall have nothing from me but hatred and contempt. Marry me first, my love, and later we will decide who gets what from whom. Do not touch me," she said. And Mungo St. John kissed her full on the mouth. It had taken almost 10 full days of leisurely riding to make a circuit of the boundaries of the ranch lands that Zuga had claimed with his land grants. It stretched eastwards from the Kami River, almost as far as the Bembezi crossing, and southwards to the outskirts of Gubuluwayo, an area the size of the county of Surrey. Rich grasslands with stretches of park-like forests and low golden hills. Through it meandered a dozen lesser rivers and streams, which watered the herds that Zuga was already grazing. Mr. Rhodes had appointed Zuga the custodian of enemy property, with powers to take possession of the royal herds of Lobengula. The 100 troopers who volunteered for the duty rounded up almost 130,000 head of prime cattle. Half of these belonged to the chartered company, but that left 65,000 to be distributed as loot to the men who had ridden into Gubuluwayo with Jamieson and St. John. However, at the very last minute, Mr. Rhodes had changed his mind and telegraphed St. John with instructions to redistribute 40,000 head to the Matabele tribe. The volunteers were incensed at having lost more than a third of their rightful loot, and word was soon spreading through the improvised bars and canteens of Gubuluwayo that the cattle had been given back to the tribe after threats and representations by the woman doctor of Kami Mission.